Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why did Pat Tillman walk away from a great life that seemed to promise only continued success and comfort in order to risk and ultimately sacrifice his life as a U.S. Army Ranger? In 2002, Tillman gave up a lucrative NFL deal, seeking deeper fulfillment and challenge through service to his country. He died less than 2 years later when members of his own platoon mistook him and some companions for enemy combatants. For many who know the story, including Tillman's friends and family, the tragedy is magnified by what appears to have been a deliberate and highly orchestrated effort by U.S. military commanders to cover up what really happened. Author John Krakauer tells the story in his latest book, recently released in tradeback with updated information. It's called Where Men Win Glory. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Pat Tillman was a voracious reader, and you were among his favorite authors. Can you talk about how that played into your involvement in telling this story?
It probably allowed me to write the book. The Tillman family is quite private, especially Pat's wife, Marie, his widow now. It's hard to imagine that she would have consented to cooperate with me and let me actually use Pat's letters and journals if Pat hadn't liked my writing. And in fact, she told me when I first met her that Pat was carrying a copy of my first book, Eiger Dreams, in his rucksack when he was killed. It wasn't actually on his person. It was in the Humvee, but it was with him in Afghanistan. So that's, you know, I think if that connection hadn't existed, it's doubtful she would have consented to let me do this.
Did you feel strange initially about saying, yes, I want to read these journals and I want to see what I can find, given that a journal is such a personal, private thing?
No, I didn't, because Marie believed that these journals, I mean, she didn't show me the most personal letters he wrote to her. She certainly withheld those. The journals, though, she felt that he meant for others to read it. Just the tone of the journals, you know, it was very personal, but she believed that this was stuff Pat wanted out there. For the same reason, she believed the book was important, that his story needed to be told. I was very grateful and honored. You know, I stayed up all night at a Kinko's copying them. She didn't, you know, give me the journals to leave with. They're way too precious to do that. So I stayed up all night copying them, and then on the plane ride home from New York, where Marie was living at the time, I started reading them and was blown away by what I read.
Another thing that he would write about, in addition to the day-to-day events of his life and his thoughts on things, were about what he was reading. Can you talk a little bit about what else he liked to read?
He was a voracious reader. I mean, even in college, his friends talk about, and his coaches said, he was never anywhere without a book. So whenever he had a spare 5 minutes, he'd crack it open and read. You know, he read after he joined the military. You know, he read the Quran to try to understand these people he would be fighting. He read Noam Chomsky. He read everything. All genres, all political points of view. He was an iconoclast. He was a free thinker. He believed it was a huge mistake to accept the conventional wisdom, whatever it was. You had to do your own research and make up your own mind. It's interesting that, you know, when he enlisted, he thought he was going to be sent to Afghanistan to try to, you know, fight Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Well, after he was enlisted, after he got out of boot camp in the winter of 2003, it became clear that the previous administration, the Bush administration, was going to invade Iraq, and he was furious. His journal reveals clearly, you know, he thought this was an illegal war. He thought it was counterproductive to U.S. interests. But he was sent to Iraq before the invasion, actually to a camp in just a few miles from the border in Saudi Arabia. And he read, for the first time, he read Ralph Waldo Emerson, his book Self-Reliance, his extended essay, that just he started reading it a couple days before the invasion. And you can see in his journals how it just totally inspired him and got him fired up. The night before the invasion, his journal is just full of all these, you know, conflicting emotions about what is he doing? What is honor? You know, what am I doing? Who am I doing this for? So it's very moving and fascinating and passionate. This is a guy, he wrote about passion in his journal, how important it was to life. You know, it was better to feel pain and agony and fear and all these things. Better to, you just needed to feel, you needed to experience life. He was a remarkable man. I mean, he wasn't, you can't pigeonhole Pat Tillman. He wasn't what, he just wasn't anything any most people imagine, including myself, before I saw his journals, before I read his journals.
He definitely comes across here loud and clear as a person who was driven to challenge himself, to push himself always beyond what he thought he might be able to do. Can you talk about how that played into his feelings as time went on about his NFL career?
It's important to note that he was driven to push himself, not just physically or mentally, but also intellectually and morally. I mean, he believed if something was right to do, you did it. You didn't go back on it because it was hard or painful. And so he pondered, after 9/11, he was really affected by the attack on the World Trade Center, especially. Marie told me that seeing these people jumping out of the upper stories of the skyscrapers, some holding hands, just really affected him. And all these other NFL players, in the days and weeks after, were talking tough about how they wanted to go kill Bin Laden with their bare hands, but none of them did anything about it. They just kept drawing their million-dollar paychecks and living comfortable lives, and that just didn't sit well with Pat. It really bugged him. And so for months, he considered what he should do, and it became clearer and clearer. Even in his journal, he mentions, sometimes you know what to do, but you just, in your heart, you know what the right thing is to do, and it takes a while to sort of realize what you already know. And that was his case. And he decided he needed to, give up football. There was more important things in life. He even said, this is just what I'm doing feels so insignificant after what's happened. And so he did this very thoughtfully. It wasn't impulsive. He weighed very carefully the effect it would have on Marie, who had been his only girlfriend. He started dating her in high school, and they'd been together ever since. And he knew it would be hard on her. He weighed all this stuff, and nevertheless, he decided that if it made sense for the U.S. to invade Afghanistan, to go after Bin Laden, and he decided it did, then who is he, an able-bodied young man, who is he to shirk his duty, his service, just because he was a pro football player? So it was a moral thing, in part. He thought it was his duty as a citizen to do this. It was also, he was attracted by the sense of adventure. He, like many young men, he wondered what it would be like to be, to test himself in combat, to be shot at, perhaps to have to shoot back and maybe even kill someone. He wasn't, it's important to note, he'd maybe touched a rifle once in his life before that. He didn't like guns. He wasn't into guns or anything like that. He understood those who were, or it's not, it wasn't something he'd thought about since he was a kid about, he wanted to join the army. It was just something he thought was the right thing to do. He was attracted for complicated reasons, part of pride and sort of masculine ideals. But ultimately, it was about duty, I think, and doing the right thing.
There was some conflict in terms of duty because you've mentioned a couple of times his widow, Marie, his high school sweetheart. And there's a sweet story in there about him putting off asking her out for years because until the end of high school, she was taller than he was.
Right. I mean, they had grown up together in this small town, Almaden, New Almaden, California, suburb of San Jose. So they'd known each other, I think, since they were four or five. They'd played soccer together, and they were always on each other's radar. But Pat was this puny, shrimpy kid. You see pictures of him, and he's this big, burly football player. But that growth spurt didn't happen until he was a senior in high school. And that's when, he finally got up the nerve to ask Marie on his first date. It was he was also young for his class. His birthday was in November, so he was one of the youngest kids in his class. I think he was still 16 when he asked her out for the first time, about to turn 17 in the fall of his senior year of high school. And, they just hit it off and stuck together. Even though they went to different colleges, they remained together. And then when Pat went to the NFL, Marie went with him. And it wasn't until after Pat decided to enlist, they discussed it. It was clear he and his brother Kevin decided they were going to join the army, that he got married. So he got married just about a month before he enlisted, before he went off to boot camp. So and it was a huge, they knew it was going to be hard on Marie as well as Pat, but neither knew how hard. I mean, there's this journal entry as he's on the airplane taking off on the way to boot camp, and he is already, he's going, oh man, what have I done? You know, I hope this isn't a huge mistake. And he continued this theme. The journal is full of self-doubt, not really self-doubt, but questioning. I mean, he wasn't one of these arrogant, cocky people who's always sure he's doing the right thing. He was always questioning himself, I mean, about everything. He was very confident. He questioned himself sort of intellectually. He said, am I doing the right thing? I know it's hard. He said, yeah, I am. Even though it's hard, in the end, both Marie and I will be stronger for this. And in fact, you know, just before he went to Afghanistan in April of 2004, he reflected on the 2 years he'd spent in the Army. And he said, this has been really hard, the hardest thing in my life. But it's been good for me. It's humbled me. He told us to his journal, you know, he felt like it had really made him a better person. It had made Marie stronger. So he, in all, even though there were times he was miserable, he thought this was a good thing to do.
We should say he had at least some comfort in that he and his brother Kevin, who he called Nub, signed up before Army Ranger training together and would, in fact, later serve in the same unit. Can you talk a little bit about their relationship?
It was unbelievably close. They were a year apart in age. Pat was a year older. This is a family that's one of the most remarkable families I've ever met. Incredibly close. Three boys. Parents, very unique upbringing. They didn't have television. They were encouraged that, you know, even in preschool to have political discussions around the table, not to accept, you know, received wisdom. So, and Kevin, you know, Kevin just, he was really different than Pat, but they were just close. And he was, after Kevin got out of college, he got a pro baseball contract. He was playing in the minor leagues for the Cleveland Indians, I think, one of their farm teams. And, you know, Marie, when Marie and Pat were discussing whether he should join the Army or not for these months, Marie at one point said to him, you know, Pat, this isn't really fair to Kevin, because whatever you do, you know there's no way he's not going to go with you. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, had to enter into Pat's reckoning as well. And he was right. I mean, Kevin and Pat, you know, they decided they were going to go together and they were going to watch each other's backs. And Kevin was a huge, it's clear from Pat's journals, especially when he was in Iraq and he was so miserable, that Kevin was a huge source of moral support for him. I mean, in some sense, Pat, this big, tough guy, he had this side to him that Marie didn't see any, you know, contradiction with, but he was very sensitive. He was a homebody. He really missed Marie. You know, he was just homesick, and he really depended on Kevin to sort of get him through those moments. He was this tough guy who could handle any kind of physical pain. But there's a side to him that was, you know, that Marie called his feminine side. And I said, well, you think, the tough guy act was just sort of this persona, this shell he wore to protect this soft, true self? Said, oh, no, they were both who he was. He was so secure with who he was, he felt no need to sort of hide this tender side. He was emotional, and he was in touch with his feelings, and he was easily brought to tears. He was a complicated and interesting guy.
It sounds like a really good set of qualities for a soldier.
Oh, an excellent set of qualities. It's interesting, you know, Pat. Pat was, I think, 25 when he enlisted, and he and Kevin sort of, most of the kids around them, you know, were 18, 19, 20 maybe, and they were young 18, 19, 20, and Pat was a mature 25, and so he really made an effort to set an example, and he'd get frustrated when these kids would, you know, at one point he called all these guys in boot camp, he just called it this house of gnats, all these sort of immature little kids screaming and whining, and, you know, he just complaining. And but he really tried to set an example. He prided himself on being a leader. He enjoyed sort of being voted the best leader in his group and stuff like that. So he took his job really seriously. He took the challenge of being a Ranger as seriously as anything in his life. He quit drinking, you know, essentially when he went to the Army, because he wanted to, you know, apply all his focus on being a soldier. He took the duties really seriously. He didn't like guns. He was uncomfortable around them, but he knew he had to learn this, and he did.
Let me have you stop right there. We need to take a quick break. John Krakauer is here. We're talking about his new book, Where Men Win Glory.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is author John Krakauer. His book, Where Men Win Glory, has been updated with new details and re-released in trade paperback. John, how did Pat Tillman decide to handle the media uproar when the announcement was made that he was going to leave the Arizona Cardinals and enlist in the Army Rangers?
Well, even before it was announced, just when he told the Cardinals, he made it clear that he'd already made up his mind he would do no interviews, and he didn't. I mean, from the time he decided to enlist until he died, he didn't give a single media interview. He just felt like, he wasn't doing it for the attention. He was doing it because it was the right thing to do. He didn't want anyone to misinterpret it. It sort of was like nobody's business. It was a personal thing. He just wanted to be a soldier and go about his business. And by all accounts, all the other soldiers I interviewed, he was a great soldier. He really was good. The Bush administration really was when it was announced that he was going to enlist, they were thrilled. They saw him as, okay, we got a new poster boy for the global war on terror, and Pat hated that. He wanted to have nothing to do with that. Even when he was in Iraq, he even told a good friend of his, a platoon mate named Jade Lane, that he was afraid that if he was killed, that the Bush administration would use him as he put it. He was afraid they would parade him through the streets. He was afraid they'd use him as a tool to sell the war, a war that in the case of Iraq certainly that he thought was a huge mistake, and he turned out to be right, exactly right. His fears came true.
And in fact, before he ever left U.S. soil, he scrawled in huge block letters on his paperwork that were he to be killed, he wanted the Army, the U.S. military, to have nothing whatsoever to do with his funeral.
That's right. That's right. He'd seen enough of the Army. He didn't trust the Army bureaucracy. He was an agnostic. I mean, he was a free thinker. He didn't want there to be. He also, on that same piece of paper you mentioned, he said he didn't want any chaplain to be, at his funeral or anything like that. And those wishes were not honored in this repatriation ceremony in Afghanistan after he's killed, after his body was shipped from the battlefield to Bagram Air Base before it was returned to the U.S. for the autopsy. The Rangers had a repatriation ceremony, and the executive officer of the regiment insisted on having a religious ceremony even after one of his subordinates pointed out, "Sir, Pat's brother says he doesn't want that," and the chaplain says, "Sorry, we're going to do this." So the Army didn't honor Pat's last wishes.
Let's go to Kevin in Dallas. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, I have a question about what Pat would think of, and I don't want to get hung up on the whole cover-up issue, but more generally speaking, civilian control of the military and how you have politically motivated elected officials commanding our uniformed services and servicemen, and philosophically the arrangement of government in that way. I'll take my answer off the air. Many thanks.
Thanks for your call. Any insight, John?
Pat was such an original thinker. I couldn't say it. I can only speculate. But, he didn't agree with everything Chomsky wrote, but he certainly admired Chomsky's own free thinking. So I think he was more worried about military. I think he would have favored more civilian control over the military. I mean, one of the problems with this cover-up, you say you don't want to go in there, was that all these investigations, it was always the Army investigating itself. It was the opposite of, like, when the plane crashed, the National Transportation, the board really tries to find out what happened. They just is totally unbiased. They really are interested in trying to find out what happened. In the case of these investigations, it was the opposite. The Army, it just instinctively, reflexively was interested in just soft-pedaling things and covering things up and not holding people accountable. So I think, more civilian sort of oversight of the military might be a good thing. And I don't know if Pat would have thought about that. He was certainly suspicious of how easy it is for military commanders, higher-ups controlling the military, to convince a nation to go to war or to embark on a policy, a surge or whatever, that's not in the nation's best interest. Soldiers, they see a problem. They think, the solution is combat, is military action. And I suspect he would have been skeptical of that.
When Tillman was deployed in Iraq, he played a sort of supplemental role in the mission to retrieve Private Jessica Lynch. And his journals there show an incredibly sharp insight into what turns out to have been the real goal of that mission. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. It's one of those. So I'm on this airplane flying back from New York to my home in Colorado, and I had no idea. No one had any idea except Pat's family, I guess. I mean, the only one person who read the journal besides me previously was his widow, Marie. And I come across that he was involved in the Jessica Lynch rescue. And I go, what? And even more amazingly, so they're assembling 1,000 special operations forces. The war is basically brought to a halt so they can rescue this private from West Virginia. And Pat is right away, his, you know, alarms are going off in his head. In his journal, the night before the rescue, the day before the rescue, he's saying, something's fishy here. You know, all this for one lowly private? I mean, there were 7 other people being held captive in Iraq at the same time. Nothing was being done to rescue them. 5 of them were from Lynch's own unit. So Pat talks about how he said, this strikes me as a big public relations stunt. Those are his exact words. He said, this is a media blitz. Something's fishy. I really hope we rescue her and everything turns out well. But, you know, he was so prescient. He really saw this before anyone else, what turned out to be exactly true. What most people don't know to this day is that this is the 4th day of the war that Jessica Lynch was captured, the 3rd day after the Iraq invasion. And that very same day, in that same city, as in part because of what happened to Lynch, 17 American Marines were killed by friendly fire. It was a bad week. It was the 4th day of the war, and things weren't going well. No one knows this because the Bush administration Jessica Lynch gives us the answer we need. We'll have this rescue. We'll sort of embellish it and turn her into this young female blonde Rambo, and no one will ask about the friendly fire. And that's right. I mean, it works so well. Eventually, you know, 6 weeks, 2-3 months later, it was revealed to be a propaganda exercise. But no one really paid attention. You know, the propaganda succeeded. It caused the military to cover up these friendly fire deaths, to cover up other aspects of the first days of the invasion that weren't going well. And 13 months later, when Tillman died, it appears that the Army said, God, that worked before. Maybe we can do something similar with Tillman. We can turn him into a hero and deflect attention from what's going on in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan at the time, which wasn't well. This is April 2004 when Pat was killed. The Battle of Fallujah was raging. Abu Ghraib broke that very same week. Bush was up for re-election in 6 months. His numbers were going down. Support for the war was going down. The Army, the military, the Defense Department couldn't handle any more bad news. They just couldn't release the fact that they'd shot their poster boy. Instead, they covered that up and turned Pat into this war hero. And you know, they tracked their numbers really carefully. And the day that Pat was killed, the day after, actually, when it became known in the States, 200 emails flowed in and out of the White House, many of which were from Bush's reelection people saying, you know, it's going to be advantageous for you to push this hard, you know, turn Pat into this hero. And they were right. The numbers showed that support for the war, support for the military was higher right after Pat was killed than it had been since the mission accomplished speech on the deck of the aircraft carrier a year earlier. So, you know, it was this very cynical exercise to promote Pat as this war hero who sacrificed his life for the global war on terror. And it worked for a while.
So let's talk, John, about what we can now say for certain actually happened on that day that Pat Tillman was killed. His platoon was out on what should have been a relatively routine mission to sort of sweep Afghan villages. Tell us about how that all played out.
Well, I spent 5 months embedded in Afghanistan, much of it in this exact area. And it's an incredibly rough country. There's no roads. So Pat's platoon was driving around in Humvees and Toyota pickups. And their roads, what served as roads, were these canyons, these dry riverbeds. And they're really rough, and they just take a toll on even Humvees. They just they bust the hell out of them. And in this case, Humvee had failed to start, so they were towing it, and it just got beat up so badly crashing around these boulders that both tie rods broke, and it couldn't even tow it anymore. So they had to do something with this vehicle. They spent hours trying to, in a Taliban-controlled village, trying to decide, arguing with headquarters what to do with this wrecked Humvee. The soldiers just wanted to blow it up. That wasn't an option. They wanted to fly it out with a Chinook helicopter. There weren't enough helicopters because of the Iraq war was using them. So they decided ultimately to split up the platoon. Half the platoon would tow this wrecked Humvee over a mountain to a paved highway The other half would continue on the clearing operations. They would drive through this narrow slot canyon, like something out of Utah, and reach this village called Mana. So they, just at dusk, it was like 6 p.m. when they finally split up. You know, Pat was in the first half that went to clear the village, and they made it through this slot canyon fine. As they're driving through, they go, wow, this is like how the Russians won the war. One of them actually said, you know, this is, they ambushed the Soviets in canyons like this. So they were very wary about being ambushed. And then the second half of the platoon was supposed to go over this mountain. They'd hired a local Afghan to use his huge 5-ton truck to tow the vehicle. And when he got to the route they were supposed to take, he said, we can't drive over this mountain. We don't need to. We can just go through the same canyon and follow the other platoon, and it's much faster and easier. So they were about 15, 20 minutes behind the first half of the platoon when they entered the slot canyon. And by this time, the Taliban, you know, they knew exactly what the Americans were doing. They'd overheard these conversations, these debates in the village. So they'd had time to set up an ambush. And sure enough, when the second half entered this slot canyon, they were attacked with mortars, small arms fire. And the second half of the platoon kind of panicked, and they just started firing wildly. And they, you know, for the next 15 minutes, they drove through this canyon. They finally came out. When they started shooting, Pat's half the platoon heard the ruckus. They saw the tracers coming out of the canyon. They stopped and climbed the canyon wall to provide covering fire when their buddies emerged from the canyon. And that's where they were when the second half came rushing out of this canyon. And basically, the second half of the platoon were reckless in their fire. By this time, the Taliban had left. There was no enemy fire by the time they got out of the canyon. And they saw Pat and an Afghan soldier who was beside him, an Afghan wearing an American uniform, but he had a beard and he had an AK-47. And they started shooting at the Afghan, and then everyone in the lead Humvee started firing in that same position. And hundreds of machine gun rounds were poured into this tiny patch of earth. And Pat was at first wounded, and then a few seconds later was shot 3 times in the head and died.
They weren't that far away, the two halves of the same platoon, but I guess it was too noisy for anyone to shout, or was there radio contact between
them? Well, one of the platoon leader, when he was told to split the platoon, he was a young lieutenant who objected strenuously, repeatedly, almost to the point of insubordination. This is a stupid idea. There's no point in doing it. We're not going to have radio contact. It's dangerous. But he was overruled, and you follow orders. So they tried to call each other, and the first half of the platoon actually could hear the second half on the radio, but they never established radio communication. So the first half, some people knew the first half of the platoon was ahead of them. Some didn't. Half of the guys had never been in combat, and they were just trigger happy. They were, you know, they just weren't experienced. Their sergeant, who was supposed to control their shooting, control their fires, failed to do that. And it's an accident. I mean, it's understandable how it happens. It was negligence. It was gross negligence. The first investigation found it was negligent homicide, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't intentional. It was a terrible accident.
Mm-hmm. If there is any silver lining in this whole story, and it's really hard to dig around and find it, it is that although the two brothers were separated into the first and the second half, it appears impossible that Kevin Tillman fired the shots that killed his brother.
No, it's absolutely impossible. Not only Kevin was in the gun turret of the last vehicle in the last half of the platoon, he didn't even get to the scene until after Pat was dead. His weapon was a type of machine gun that fires grenades, and it jammed when the firefight first started. He tried to load a grenade onto the bolt face, and it jammed. So his weapon wasn't even operable. There's no doubt. I mean, Kevin had nothing to do with it. He was in no way involved. So there is that small comfort. Although I don't think it was much of a comfort.
At what point did everybody in that platoon understand exactly what had just taken place?
Well, many of the platoon members were on the hillside seeing the second half of the platoon shoot at Pat. And so basically, as it happened, most people in the first half of the platoon knew exactly what had happened. Within minutes, when it was over, basically everyone knew what had happened, except Kevin. I mean, Kevin didn't even know his brother had been killed. Eventually, a sergeant told him, "Hey, your brother's been killed," but he wasn't told it was friendly fire at all. He was, you know, that evening he was flown back to the forward operating base. The next day, he accompanied Pat's body to Bagram Air Base and then to the States. And Pat and Kevin was deliberately kept in the dark. The soldier who kept Kevin company, who knew it was friendly fire on the long flight home, was ordered to say nothing, to lie. A lot of soldiers were ordered to lie. Pat's uniform was burned. His notebook was burned. His body armor was burned. The cover-up, I mean, it began reflexively, and I don't even think people thought it through. But from the get-go, they were totally hypersensitive that this not leak out. By the next morning, by the next day, it was known. Everyone knew, except Kevin, on the ground, knew that it was friendly fire. And word went up the chain of command. Word went up secret back channels to the White House and Pentagon. And at that point, within 24 hours, a decision was made. The paper trail leads to Stanley McChrystal, General Stanley McChrystal, who was the command of the Joint Special Operations Command at that time. He was the one who ordered the cover-up. Now, there's, you know, circumstantial evidence that he did so at the behest of the Vice President Dick Cheney and/or the Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, but there's no proof of that. So either it was McChrystal's idea on his own, or he was, you know, doing the bidding of those in the civilian White House. But in any case, it was an extraordinary thing to do. This isn't just a cover-up in the sense of, okay, we're just going to shut up and not tell anyone. It was a very aggressive, proactive effort to head off information. There was a fraudulent Silver Star medal submitted by McChrystal. There was McChrystal had his army lawyers obstruct a CID investigation. Now, this is one of the key things, is that when Pat's body was shipped back to the States for the autopsy and the medical examiner examined it, first thing he noticed was Pat came back without any clothes on, no uniform, none of the things that are required by regulation. When a body comes back, you know, everything that's considered forensic evidence, could be forensic evidence, is supposed to go back with the body, the uniform, the body armor, the helmet. All that was missing. And the wounds, Pat's wounds, did not match with what the medical examiner had been told by the Rangers. He was suspicious from the instant he started the autopsy. He refused to sign the autopsy report. He was so concerned. He was saying, something's fishy here. This just isn't right. And he tried to get answers. The Rangers wouldn't give him any. So he called the CID, the Army Criminal Investigation Command.
Let me have you pause right there, and we'll finish the story in a minute. John Krakauer is with us. We're talking about his book, now out in trade paperback, Where Men Win Glory. We'll be back to the conversation in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author John Krakauer. We're talking about his book, Where Men Win Glory, which has just been updated and re-released in trade paperback. So you were telling the story, John, of the physician performing Pat Tillman's autopsy, sees something amiss, calls the Army's Criminal Investigation Division and says what?
Well, you got to remember, the CID is like the FBI of the Army. They can do whatever they want. You're supposed to answer their questions. You can't refuse to answer them. You can't lie to them. If you do, you can be imprisoned. I mean, it's a big deal. And so what happened was McChrystal dispatched Army lawyers to obstruct the CID investigation because he knew that, you know, if the CID started investigating it, there's no way to bottle it up. It would be news. So a young lawyer basically, you know, managed to spend all this time discussing Tillman with the CID investigator and hide the fact that it was friendly fire. So the CID went, you know, in Afghanistan, said, well, we can't say anything amiss here. There's no friendly fire. There's nothing wrong. There's no need to have an investigation. So McChrystal effectively obstructed this investigation, which is doubly painful because there's a couple of Army regulations and actually a law passed by Congress that says when a soldier is killed by friendly fire or even suspected friendly fire, the next of kin needs to be notified quickly. And they, you know, even if it's only suspected, you are required by regulation and federal law, the Army is the commanding officer, to notify the family. And the CID is required because friendly fire is by definition in military law negligent homicide, the CID is required to start an investigation. So, you know, McChrystal thwarted all these regulations, all these protocols, and managed to keep a lid on it. And then, you know, adding insult to injury, he submitted this fraudulent Silver Star that in which there was no mention of friendly fire. He submitted this to the Secretary of the Army. You know, it made it seem like Pat was killed by the Taliban. A day, less than 24 hours after submitting this fraudulent medal recommendation to the Secretary of the Army, McChrystal sent a secret back channel email to his commanding general saying, hey, someone needs to warn the president's speechwriters not to use this Silver Star I just sent in, because if he does, and if it ever leaks out that Tillman was killed by friendly fire, the president's going to look like a liar. So, you know, make sure he doesn't mention it in this. It was just a few days before the White House correspondence dinner, and McChrystal was worried that Bush would, you know, say something, quote this medal recommendation in his speech. So it was really, you know, this wasn't a passive, just let's be quiet and this will go away. This was a very active and orchestrated conspiracy to mislead the public. I mean, you know, there's parallels to the Watergate. The main difference is that in the Watergate investigation, the investigators were men of principle who were determined to reveal the truth and punish the guilty, whoever they were, you know, take it wherever it led them. And it led to, you know, Nixon resigning and people going to jail. In the case of the Tillman cover-up, it was the Army investigating itself. It was the investigators and the arbiters were all toadies to power who were more interested in protecting the powerful and protecting the Army's reputation and the administration's reputation than revealing the truth. So nobody to this day to speak of, certainly none of the most culpable people, have been punished at all. To the contrary, they've all been promoted. You know, McChrystal was made a four-star general and commander of Afghanistan.
That's over now, but yes.
Yeah, but he was, I mean, it's ironic, you know, he committed this serious crime, submitting a false official statement, and it was clear, anyone who looked at the investigation carefully knows he did this, and yet the Army kept, you know, giving him a free pass, and it wasn't until he was guilty of insubordination that he was removed from his command.
Now, McChrystal has said, yes, I signed the Silver Star order, but I just didn't look it over carefully enough to realize that there might be a mistake with it. You don't buy that.
That is so preposterous. You got to remember, this Silver Star recommendation is, I think, seven short paragraphs. It's not 300 pages. It's seven paragraphs. McChrystal is famous for being obsessively meticulous. He doesn't tolerate mistakes. He's a detail-oriented guy. For him to submit this medal recommendation for the most famous soldier in the Army without bothering to read it, give me a break. I mean, that's preposterous. He said that. You know, he said he didn't read it carefully when he was testifying before Senate. He lied to the Senate Armed Services Committee. It's just unbelievable. And he got away with it. You know, he's an amazingly effective commander. He was. He's an honorable man in many ways. He's a great soldier. He's a brilliant commander. And yet, and because of that, people just were reluctant to challenge him. He got a free pass. That's how everything happened.
Let's speak with Ron in Richardson. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Well, you kind of took my question because I was going to mention McChrystal, so I would like to perhaps make an observation and then ask your guest for his opinion. As he said, it was an active and, orchestrated conspiracy to deceive the public. And when I look back just merely as a citizen in Dallas, Texas, and I see that the Department of Defense under Cheney was the only group that was pumping out the fake WMD Al-Qaeda connections, that the White House purged the Pentagon of any dissenting opinion about the war in Iraq. 3 weeks ago, in testimony before the Parliament, the Prime Minister's assistant said he met with Cheney 2 days after 9/11 and was told we were invading Iraq, a story that was not reported by any major news outlets here in the U.S. And you've got Jessica Lynch, who, to her credit, admitted that she and refused to be part of this propaganda machine. Pat Tillman, we now know that drones are killing 10 times more civilians than they are killing terrorists, you know, the WikiLeaks. And I guess my question is, our national media is beyond contempt. They are such cheerleaders. And I want to know why, in your opinion, your story and these other stories don't get covered. You know, and I just want to say NPR is complicit in this. Even now, after 9 years, they give fawning coverage of the Pentagon. There is never a challenge of any of the statements. In fact, it's basically they're stenographers for the Pentagon.
Well, let's
never
get a
hear
response
a critic
for you
of the Pentagon on NPR. and you never hear. I want to thank you, though, for having him on this show. You and Terry Gross are the only people that have really interviewed this gentleman.
Well,
and again, I want to thank him for his service to his country.
I appreciate your call, Ron. Thank you very much. John, comment on NPR, the media in general?
There's no doubt. The American media, the national media, was lax in its criticism. But it's not that uncommon. As Pat and his brother discussed, when they were in Iraq, they're students of history, and they were very familiar with Hermann Göring's famous comments when he was on trial for the Nuremberg for the Holocaust, in which he said, "Look, it's easy for leaders to convince their people to go to war. You just criticize the pacifists as you know being subversive and inspire people's patriotism." So the press, you know, in the case of the American press, it's not to forgive them, but it's common that you know the press in times of war is reluctant to criticize the leaders, and the Bush administration, they were masters. They were terrible at executing the wars, but they were, you know, they took the level of propaganda, of manipulating public opinion, of managing perception, as they put it, to whole new levels. Spending, you know, they had a $200 million program during the early days of the Iraq War to do this, and they were very good at it. And they knew how to. And McChrystal himself, it was a master at this. I mean, it's worth noting that, you know, until McChrystal spoke to Rolling Stone and cost him his job, he did that. People, why did he ever talk to Rolling Stone? Because it worked. He'd done so many. He let so many journalists in on, you know, do profiles of him, and all of them, almost all of them, were fawning. You know, even people who criticized his policy, they in the end, you kept thinking they painted McChrystal as this Superman, this sort of wonder boy who he alone can make this work, even though you know Karzai is not dependable and we seem to be losing. So I mean, it had worked for McChrystal. He opened himself up to press who are normally hostile, and in the case of Michael Hastings, Rolling Stone, for the first time, a reporter wasn't sort of blinded, and he could see the emperor had no clothes and reported what he saw. So,
well, do you think, John, that that's an inevitable consequence, Rolling Stone accepted, of and Hastings accepted, of the embedding process?
Well, it's not inevitable, but I mean, whoever decided to start embedding journalists, you know, that was a brilliant public relations thing. I mean, I was embedded for 5 months, and, you know, you as a journalist, when the shooting starts, you are really grateful to these guys for saving your ass. And it's hard to imagine, you know, it's really hard for journalists to criticize the men who are protecting them. You know, it shouldn't be so hard to criticize their leaders. I mean, I came away, as most embedded journalists do, with amazing respect and admiration for the soldiers on the ground. But at the same time, you know, when their leaders are lying about things like friendly fire, that's not in the soldier's best interest. It's, you know, bad policy is in the interest of anyone serving the military. It's not. I mean, we forget how much damage these wars have done to the military. I mean, I'm 56. I was around for the end of the Vietnam War. I was of draft age and luckily got a high number. But people forget it took 20 years, took a generation for the military to repair itself from the damage that the Vietnam War did. And these wars seem to be doing a similar kind of damage to the military. So it's not, you know, it's not unpatriotic to point out bad policy or bad leaders or, you know, or malfeasance.
You have said this is pretty much the hardest book you've ever written. Can you explain why?
Oh, God, it was just because it's the Army, and it is so hard. You know, you can't. It's much harder than other branches of government to arrive at the truth because they're so much more insulated. It was hard spending 5 months in Afghanistan. It was incredibly difficult. It was scary. You know, it was hard just getting soldiers to talk to me. It was all kinds of things are difficult about this book.
I think we have time to take one more call. Let's go to Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. Has there been any independent investigation besides the military investigating itself, investigating this issue? And maybe was there any hint of conspiracy because Pat was a soldier and also entertainer, I mean, celebrity, so they were afraid of his influence and saying things other than what military wanted the public to believe? Was there any independent investigation?
I guess you're suggesting, was there any chance that he was intentionally killed? I don't believe so, and I looked into this very carefully. Now, the Tillman family is not convinced of that. They've been lied to so much, I don't blame them for their skepticism. But I do not believe that he was killed deliberately. He was incredibly popular. I don't think the Army cared that much. You know, Pat spoke his mind to other soldiers, but it wasn't widely known in the public that he opposed the war, for instance. So, and there was no independent investigation. Even Congress investigated the House of Representatives, but they don't have subpoena power. McChrystal refused to appear before the committee. The closest to an independent investigation was the Department of Defense, rather than the Army did one investigation, in which they found McChrystal should be held accountable. But they couldn't punish McChrystal. They turned it back to the Army to decide what sort of censure or punishment he should get. And the Army said, oh, he's done nothing wrong. They just ignored the whole DOD investigation, the Inspector General's investigation. So, no, there's never been anything close to – there should have been a criminal investigation. This was negligent homicide, not intentional, but there should have been like a criminal investigation in which people are subpoenaed, and that just didn't happen. I mean, so there's much that's unknown and probably will never be known.
I think, John, one of the heartbreaks of this story is clearly it's sad when any soldier is killed, whether a celebrity or not. But Pat Tillman was so intelligent and so thoughtful that at the end of this, had he lived, and who's to say where his opinion would have fallen once it was all over, but it would have been great to be able to hear from him about the entire extent of his experience overseas.
Oh, man. He would have written quite a book. He could have. I mean, he was, there's so many sad things about this, but to see someone that unique and with that much potential, his life cut short at 27 when it was just getting going. He never thought pro football was a be-all and end-all. He was ready to move on, and 9/11 made him see there's more to life than football, and he at that time he chose to go into the military, but he would have done something remarkable. We can only imagine what it would have been.
What's Kevin Tillman doing these days?
I haven't talked to Kevin in a long time. He got out of the Army. He finished his contract. He stayed in a year after Pat died. And he's married and has a kid. And, he's a private guy, so he's fully capable of talking when and if he wants to.
And Marie?
Marie, she started the Pat Tillman Foundation. She and Pat's friends, which is amazing success story. Its focus now is on servicemen who are returning, many of them with traumatic brain injuries and PTSD, and it helps them and their families get an education. It's an amazing organization, PatTillmanFoundation.org. And so she created that. She's still deeply involved with that and is trying to get over this terrible tragedy.
The latest book by author John Krakauer has been updated with additional information for the trade paperback edition. It is called Where Men Win Glory. John, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Chris, thanks very much for having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis, an engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.